Hall. Miss Hall. Miss Hall, I beg your pardon.
His sister. Eventually, he died relatively young, but eventually he had first sold his patent rights to the Aluminum Company of America, and this is where they got their money from.
And they retired, and Alco took over the business then?
And the reason that she was so pleased was that this was an aluminum body seat. She was an elderly lady.
Well, how were the how were these special town cars received by the Ford family? Did you get any personal reaction from anyone or through?
Yeah, the personal reaction I got out of the first one that was made for Mrs. Edsel Ford.
Okay. That was Eleanor Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Bill's mother, you know.
Right.
And was that the...
Delightful lady.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I went up there in 44. This was about 1937 or 8.
Uh-huh.
So I was 6 or 7 years old, and damn it, she wasn't still using this car.
44?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
She was using it in 45.
Right.
And I happened to have a little acquaintance with the chauffeur.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I was told, I received a message from on high that I was to supervise the restoration of this car for Mrs. Ford.
Right.
Minus the mechanical parts.
Right.
So that took me off of the interior trim and color job with Ted Hobbs for about 6 weeks.
Oh.
And as a matter of fact, we did that twice.
Did you?
Yeah, that once after I was there a couple of years, and a second time 2 years later. See, the boys were after her to get a new car, for crying out loud.
She loved it.
Yeah, well, she liked to step up, and she liked the headroom and everything, and you go down to the Ford Hospital there, and first car right up at the door, or first space right up at the door was reserved for her, and
mm-hmm.
the chauffeur would be sitting in there, and I'd pass a few words with him, and then they finally brought it in, and they put that current grill on that I don't like.
Yeah.
You know the one?
Mm-hmm.
It's also on the Sunshine Special, you know the Sunshine Special?
The 42 grill.
The 42
the ugly
grill?
The 42 grill.
You know that Sunshine Special?
Mm-hmm.
That we built for FDR?
Well, you can tell me about it a little bit later, but go ahead.
Well, anyway, I was just telling you about that. Yeah. We restored that car for her twice until about 1946 or 48. The boys finally prevailed upon her to let her make a new job for us.
Who did that one?
Well, I'll tell you who did it. We designed it. I don't mean me, but
yeah.
In the styling department there.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Ray Diedrich was running on going back into business in Kalamazoo.
Oh, was he really?
And we were doing some business with him. Where I got connected was in building trim bucks, these skeleton wood bucks that we used to upholster and reupholster and tear it out and reupholster again, you know, to see how the trim style looked in
mm-hmm.
the upholster.
Right.
When we used to get $5,000 for a body, a whole complete body, that was a good price. Well, Ray was getting $5,000 a piece for these skeletons.
Oh, no.
Well, anyway, this job was given to him to build for Mrs. Edsel Ford. And you remember Talberg?
V.Y.
Talberg?
V.Y. Talberg, yeah, right.
Top that weaseling. That's what he used to holler at his help. Stop that weaseling.
He meant whistling, of course.
Huh?
He meant whistling?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And
he was your body engineer, wasn't he, that time?
No, he wasn't a body engineer, but he was a general manager of that whole
engineering
operation there,
yeah.
And of building the new buildings and everything.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh.
Uh, she was, Thalberg was the, he could do anything around there that he wanted.
Uh-huh.
The family thought a lot of him.
Uh-huh.
Principally, I was told that he was manager of the Ford plant in Cologne just when the Nazis took over.
Ah, okay.
Have you heard this story?
No, I haven't.
Well, he was manager there, and he got out just before the Nazis took the place over. We were not in the war yet, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'm only repeating this.
Yeah.
With two suitcases full of money.
American money.
American money. Yeah. A lot of money.
Mm.
I've heard.
Was that personal?
I've heard anywhere from $1 million to $100,000 and stuff like that.
Was that personal money or was it Ford money?
Company money.
Company money. Okay.
Yeah, this is the way he got into the good graces of the Ford family when he got over here with all that money, and then
mm-hmm.
he was given a job as a charge of a bunch of tool designers, and they'd whistle, and that's how they up to call him Top That Weaseling Thalberg. Otherwise, he was the manager of that whole engineering and development area there while that was going on, you know.
So he sort of supervised that last
yeah, like revision. The dynamometer building, they built our building, the style building.
But I mean, he supervised the last refurbishment of the town car.
Yeah.
Who did the actual design?
And then what I was going to tell you about Thalberg
yeah.
got wind that the sheriff was creeping up on Dietrich up there.
In Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo, and they...
What was the name of Dietrich's company up there? Do you remember?
What?
What was the name of Dietrich's company in Kalamazoo?
I don't know. I think it was Dietrich.
Oh, just Ralph Dietrich? Yeah.
Anyway, they got Thalberg
and
another fellow up there who was his right-hand man got a bunch of trucks together and went up there in the middle of the night and got this car of Mrs. Ford's.
Oh, it was up there being done.
Out of there before the sheriff locked the doors.
What year was this?
Hmm?
What year was this?
Well, this would have been about 19, I don't know, 49 or 50 or
okay.
something like that.
All right.
And there wasn't much work done on it. They had the structure up, but they had also had the working drafts and so forth, and they got those in the car and they drove them down here before the sheriff closed the door the next day.
And they trailered the car itself down, too.
Well, I don't know how they trailered it. They said they brought it down with the truck. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, okay. Large truck.
Probably was just the body, not the yeah. chassis or anything.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And it was finished up there. Finished up in the engineering lab over there. Not the engineering lab, the
styling lab.
Not the styling lab. What was the building across the street that we now call the Triple
E building?
Triple E building. What's the other one over there? Where they built the...
Well, the old engineering laboratory.
Where they built the airplanes for a while.
Well, the airplane factory.
Airframe.
Airframe factory.
Airframe. They built it up there and they spent about $400,000 getting it finished.
One story I heard, maybe you knew this, was that she had it cut especially high because...
This one?
Well, the last model, she liked it up high, as you said, but this last model, she had a neck ailment,
yeah.
which she didn't like to bend to get out, so she had it cut very high. So she could sort of walk out of it, as you say, at the hospital. Was that your notion?
Well, I remember that car. I remember it was very high, and I also remember that it, as we used to do, we did in a car for Colonel Green. I don't know whether you know who Colonel...
No, who's Colonel Green?
Well, I'll tell you later.
Okay.
He cut the door up, opening up into the roof, and back into the roof, and then you brought it back here, and then those people like that could get in here. Oh, Colonel Green was the son of Hetty Green, known as the Witch of Wall Street.
Hetty? H-E-T-T-Y?
Yeah, you never heard of her?
Yes, but these people have.
She was a millionaire and a poverty looked like she was poverty stricken, lived in a cold water walk up flat, and
she looked like today's bag ladies, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
But one of the banks, I don't know whether it was National City or what it was, gave her a desk in their lobby. If you want to read an interesting book, you want to read The Day They Shook the Plum Tree. This is about when they were all dead and there was $100 million estate sale. Well, anyway, she had this $100 million and she was a millionaireess, and she had this one boy, Ned, who fell down and broke his leg and it was not properly set because she went to a cheap doctor. And eventually had to have it amputated up from the knee down. Well, the colonel was a Texas colonel.
Or a Kentucky colonel.
No, not Kentucky.
Or a Texas colonel.
He was a Texas colonel.
She
sent him down there to get some training and running. She was grabbing up railroads all over. This was called the Texas of the Southern. And strange to say, for being quite a playboy, he did a pretty good job. He put the thing on his feet. He and his girlfriends that lived in this hotel together, and she held the purse strings for a long time, but when she died, boy, he really went to town.
Yeah.
And I went down to Albany with Victor and met the chauffeur down there, and we had designed this car on a 150-inch, 160-inch wheelbase ambulance chassis for him.
Good heavens.
And this roof was cut up, the door was cut up into the roof, and we had a movable seat that moved out from the back and swiveled, and then he stepped out.
The first of the handicap appliances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty close, yeah.
If I had time or it helped here, I'd just show you the pictures of all that stuff.
You described it graphically very
but,
what year was that, roughly?
That was 1931, because that was a 31 chassis. That was one of the first chassis that had the radiator curved out like that. But it was an ambulance chassis, 160 inches.
Yeah.
And then we built him another one on 136-inch chassis, just a two-seater job. And he was a great cigar smoker, and we had to put ashtrays in there that contained water so he could dunk them.
That's wrong.
And another interesting story, I'm jumping around.
No,
this is not
do.
In
yeah, that's all right.
Chronology, was Glenn Curtis.
Now this is two N's and two S, three S's, right?
You know, Glenn Curtis.
I mean, just for the typist. G-L-E-N-N, C-U-R-T-I-S-S, two S, yeah, okay,
C-U-R-S, C-U-R-S-T-I-C-E is Harold Curtis.
Okay, yeah, right, yeah, we got to get him, C-U-R-T-I-C-E.
S-S, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And he came from Hammondsport, not far from Buffalo, the wine country down there. And first he was a bicycle maker, and then he was a motorcycle racer, and then he got to building airplanes. And this was shortly after the Wright brothers' time. And
well, the museum, the Henry Ford Museum, has one of his early
seaplanes.
The Henry Ford Museum has one of its early seaplanes.
Yes, I think so. And he always wore a tweed cap and a tweed coat, and one morning he walks into the showroom and said his name is Curtis, and he was moving his plant from Hammondsport up to Buffalo, and he was told that Brun was the guy that could build him a new car on Pierce Arrow.
Hammondsport where?
Hammondsport, New York.
Yeah.
That's in the south central part of the state where they got a lot of grapes going. And he became a great friend of my father's and a great friend of everybody's, because he hung around the shop and was on first name basis with a lot of the employees, and he contributed a lot to the design of things, such as streamlining and things like that.
Aerodynamics, maybe?
Aerodynamics, that's what it was in those days.
Right.
Well, anyway, this was on a Pierce Arrow 66 chassis. And
what year again?
Well, it must have been, well, wait a minute, it was 1916, because he took it down to his home in Florida after we had gotten in the war. And the car had these Westinghouse air springs out. I don't know whether you know them, but they improved the ride. They were a projectile-shaped thing made by Westinghouse, and it was kind of a air. It improved the ride of the car.
Really? Air suspension, huh?
Yeah, we got, they looked like a artillery projectile hung on the front and on the back. But it did improve the ride of the car. This was before shock absorbers and so forth.
Always a problem in those days.
We got two on the front and two on the rear, and this big rounded thing, and he always used to laugh and tell. He said, you know, when I got down there, I got a call from the police department. And he said they were getting complaints from people who had seen this fantastic looking vehicle in the dark down there, in the dusk, and we better go and find out whether it was some infernal machine that the Germans had landed on the beaches down in Florida. this car. And then we built a couple other marmots for him, and a Pierce Arrow and Cadillac Town Car, which we lengthened. I don't know, I saw it in here.
I want to show you, yeah, see if that was the one. There it is, yeah.
No, that's only his separate, right? You know this car?
I wanted to ask you about it.
This was a town car that Mr. Ford wanted us to try to make a town car on a Zephyr.
Okay.
Well, they sent a Zephyr.
Well, you mean Edsel Ford?
Edsel.
In the late 30s? Early 40s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They sent a four-door convertible.
Lincoln Zephyr.
Lincoln Zephyr down, and we built the body on top of it. Well, it didn't go because there wasn't any room in it, and that is why they went on and built this one. But
there was a slant
all
back.
Of a sudden, I
look at the slant back, marvelous.
Huh? Yeah. Well, we just continued that line on up there, but a year ago or so, since I was in California, a guy called me on the phone from Westminster, California. It's down, I guess, near Long Beach or down that way somewhere. Sending me a photograph. He's got this car.
He's got it?
Yeah. And he was fixing it up. And he came up here and he stayed to lunch one day. And he paid for some photographs that I had to have made. And about a year later, I got a notice that here's the car. Canopy's off and a chauffeur standing there, and he's just gotten married, and he's going off on his honeymoon in this car.
With a chauffeur?
Well, at the wedding, I don't know.
Oh, okay. At the wedding.
I don't know whether they were taking him on the
he's driving out. This is a special cabriolet.
Yeah, he's got it down there. I haven't seen him since, but he seemed real happy with it.
This is a classic Lincoln Zephyr four-door, and you've lengthened the earth.
We didn't lengthen anything. That's the trouble. They didn't send any top with it.
But you put the top on.
Well, we built a top.
The cabriolet top, yeah. Did that cabriolet top fold back, or was that a faux cabriolet?
No, that didn't fold.
That was a false cabriolet.
Yeah.
That's marvelous. About this, tell us a little bit about this tradition this looks like to be master craftsmen with the tools of their trade, still making the hand-built town car rear deck.
This was a hammer, air hammer.
Well, no, at least he's working on the trim, the exterior trim. He's got a hammer in his hand. You can see that.
Well. He's evidently here. This guy's got an air hammer.
Okay, and the one on top, however, has a smoother, a soft hammer, does he not?
This?
Yeah.
No, that's a mallet.
A mallet, but he's just pounding out. He's also pounding out.
No, this was hand hammered on a form.
Right, even though you're working in 1938, you're still using the time-honored methods of hand
Well, the only reason why still we're working in 1938, when you're only making five, you don't go ahead and spend a lot on tooling, see?
Right, exactly, yeah, right. I want to read you.
I talked about Mrs. Blair's limit, panel broom down at the Capital Cadillac Company.
Yes.
In Washington.
Yeah.
That's Mrs. Blair's. I assume she's related to that family in the Blair house, or so I was told.
Mm-hmm. Who sold it to the government.
Sold it to who?
Sold it to the government. Eventually.
Yeah, well, they call it Blair house. Remember, Truman lived there while they were refurbishing the White House.
And the Puerto Rican assassins almost got
him. Yeah, that's right.
Standing, looking out the window.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if you could read something for us from your narrative here. I wanted to...
Pardon?
A footnote. I wonder if you would read a paragraph for me to us about the interior coachwork. I have it right here.
Interior. Now, here's Ezra Ford's Hispano.
Now, this is Ezra Ford's Hispano Suiza of the early 20s.
Yeah, that's
you did the coachwork for. He bought the Hispano Suiza
chassis and shipped it over.
And you and Brun did the coachwork.
Yeah,
that was your first commission from Edsel Ford. Wasn't
yes,
it
really was.
Right. Yeah.
Now there's Glenn Curtis's war machine.
Can you describe this? That's incredible. Let me take you. Tell us a bit about this, Curtis.
Well, I mean, as I say, he was in the shop and kept his eye on the work and. Became on a first name basis with a lot of the workmen, and
he kept it at least through the war.
We made five of him.
Five
you know when he was the first man to fly from Albany down to New York. And the New York World put up a $10,000 prize, and he told his wife, "If we win this prize, I'll buy you a smart little runabout."
Oh, I see.
I've read this in the story by Laura Scudder about his biography, and
I spoke gutter.
They had to stop at Poughkeepsie get gas, but he got down there, and he was given kind of a Charlie Lindbergh welcome there, you know.
The first man to fly from Albany to New York?
Yeah. They had a stop on the way to get gas about Poughkeepsie. And I got the story where I wrote it up for Antique Automobile saying it didn't say, okay. Laura Scudder doesn't say that whether she got her smart little runabout or not, but she did get five run cars on pure service and Marmons. He was a great Marmon man.
Or was he?
Yeah, within the next 6 years.
Did you have any relationship with Colonel Marmon himself?
No.
In the early days?
You mean, oh, there was a Howard.
Oh, Howard.
Who was Howard?
Howard Marmon.
Yeah. I've never heard him called Colonel, but
yeah.
No, I didn't, but...
he may have been another Texas colonel.
Well, it might have been.
Well,
it was called the Nordyke and Marmon Company.
Later, yeah, right.
Later?
I would like to have you read, if you would, one of your description of the internal furnishings of the of typical Brun interiors, could you?
Well, have you got it there?
Yeah, right here. Start at the bottom of the page and turn over the page until it's finished.
I'll confess you now, I'm blind at one eye.
That's right. No problem.
I've had what you call a macular degeneration.
Is that what it is?
Uh-huh. Well, it's a ruptured blood vessel which spreads around the eye.
You're doing fine.
Well, they still let me drive a car.
You're doing fine, yeah. Down at the bottom of this page here, yeah.
The two photos shown in figure 10 and 11 are typical Brun interiors. The interior treatment and appointments were outstanding features of Brun coachwork. The upholstery material is invariably face finished wool broadcloth, although occasionally a pattern cloth was used if the customer was so inclined. The style of the trim scheme was either perfectly plain cushions and backs, or if the an extra bit of luxury was wanted, pleats with deeply drawn buttons was used. Toward the end, we used pleats and buttons exclusively.
Yes.
You've probably seen one in there. Coil springs and animal hair topped off with a layer of down provided the customer with apparent luxury. Handmade garnish moldings of mahogany finished off the windows and directly beneath the window opening on the top of the door and across the face of the partition were panels of highly finished crotch mahogany veneer. Mahogany was also used for whatever cabinets and vanity cases the car was equipped with. Occasionally other rare woods were used, such as the blonde zebra wood or jet black Macassar ebony. Sometimes to make the interior more elegant, oval wedgewood medallions were recessed in the center of these rare wood panels. The interior hardware was an exclusive Brunn design, very severe and dignified in style. They were either finished in Butler silver or antique bronze, whichever harmonized with the interior ensemble. Another exclusive Brunn feature was the imported sheepskin floor covering. These were imported from Australia and furnished a plush air of luxury, as well as providing the most practical type of floor covering. No real fine, elegant vehicle was complete without a Brunn custom-made lap robe. Even with the coming of the rear compartment heaters, the monogram robe was needed to top off a fine piece of coachwork. The face of these robes were usually of the same broadcloth material as used on the seats. The back was a deep pile plush, or in the case of a more sporty turnout, a hog's tooth check.
Perfect.
Scott Salas?
Thank you, yes. Thank you. I think that's a marvelous, I'm glad you read it, because that's a marvelous description of the most, what it seems to me to be the most tasteful yet elaborate interior trim that could be had in those.
I said, how would you like to get thrown around inside that car?
No, not really. There's one just before we leave that type of perfection that the Brunn company offered. There's a note in a little piece I read by Hugo Fow. He says that, which you did not mention, he said that back in the heyday of the custom body era, one of the finest pierced arrows was a town car for the Shah of Iran.
See that light one up there?
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how that came about?
Yeah, well, the town car for the Shah of Persia, as he was known then,
right,
was the father of the...
Of the Shah who was...
Of the Shah who is now dead, too.
Right.
We got word
from... This in the 20s, or...?
What?
This in the 1920s?
No, this was 1933, I think.
33, okay.
Yeah. We got word from the sales manager out of Pierce Arrow that they had got an order from some representative of theirs over in Persia that they wanted a white, to be painted white, a parade car for the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
And did we think we could do it? Well, we sure did, but he said, we had to keep it simple. I made that design, that drawing there, and
right,
nothing, not much to it as far as design is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all white. The radiator shell was gold plated.
Mm-hmm.
molding along there now.
How about the interior? How about the interiors?
Let me see that thing over there.
Okay, I'll get.
No, I mean that pile over
there. Oh, okay. Now, the Shah, being a very rich man, obviously enjoyed having a gold appointments. How did that come about?
How did it come about?
I mean, you got the order from Pierce Arnold?
Yeah, we were just in the hardware.
And what did he say? He wanted
to be gold.
He wanted solid gold as much as he could?
Yeah.
Now, you worked out, you said gold plate on the exterior. How'd that work out?
Worked out fine.
Mechanically, huh?
Worked out fine, but let me go on about this gold.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Oh, here's another one here. You see, that was the Royal Crown.
No, no, before you describe it.
Press.
Well, you're
here's
describing.
Here's what we were sent. We were sent specifications. It was a speed, whatever the wheelbase was on that Pierce Arrow car. And
now, what type of model is it when you say Pierce Arrow car?
Well, it's a town car.
Which is?
A parade car.
Yeah, and was Pierce Arrow still making these, obviously, in 32?
No, nobody, this is the only one ever made.
Okay, Pierce Arrow did not make town cars.
Pierce Arrow made the chassis.
Chassis only, you're doing the town car body.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
fine,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Now, you see that crown there?
What crown where? I don't see any.
On the door.
Yeah.
That was the Royal Crown of Persia.
Which door was it on?
On both rear doors.
Yeah, but they can't
see. On both
see
rear doors, right. You would see the Royal Crown of Persia.
That's the crest, the
crest,
the royal family.
Now this,
crest,
we got that by them sending us a picture of the Shah and his royal robes.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to bring this up to the proper size, I had it blown up photographically.
You blew up his crown?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now this was supposed to be an emerald in here and all the rest was gold. Well, it wasn't an emerald, but it was green and it looked like it.
This is in the center of the crown, the front piece.
Right here, yeah.
And how did you discern the crest from that, or what happened?
Well, we photographed this and gave it to some jeweler to make.
But what did you see in that circle? What is the crest or the emblem?
Well, in the description of it, which I have somewhere else, this was green emerald.
Yeah, got that.
And the press got a hold of this, and really went to town.
You didn't just put a green emerald on there, didn't you put some sort of filigree or scroll work or?
Well, all this stuff was gold around here. Well,
what do you got? Let's see. Oh, I see. You just simply reproduced the whole crown.
The whole crown, the size which we thought fit the area where it was going to go. See,
I thought you had taken from the crown what appeared to be the royal family.
No, this is.
I see. You simply reproduced his formal crown.
Right.
Okay. Fine. From the front. Yeah. And you had a jeweler do that.
Yeah, a jeweler did that, and then they attached it on with it.
What sort of reaction did you get from that? Any semi-official from the Shah of Persia?
I don't know if we got any reaction from him, but we got a big reaction from the press.
Did you? What happened?
Well, the minute it was done, there was a Pierce Arrow had a very nice showroom, or the dealer did there in Buffalo.
Okay.
On Main Street in Jewett, a Cadillac dealer eventually took it over, but this was a beautiful show, and they put it in there, and nothing else in there with floodlights down on it at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they had a traffic jam out there. And I have a book. I can't find it.
That's right.
Clipping book.
Yeah.
With clippings sent to us. My father put an outfit by the name of Romicky.
R-O-M-I?
They are a clipping bureau.
Oh, of course, yes, right. Yeah,
Are they still gone? I don't know.
No, they're long gone.
But anyway, you send them so much money, And they'll send you every mention of the Shah of Persia in any damn newspaper in the country.
Oh, yeah. Typical, yes.
Huh?
That's a typical a service you can employ, yeah, you can purchase.
I didn't know whether we're still around or not, but it was...
Well, there are others, yeah. Henry, Ford Motor Company subscribed to it, too, yeah. R-O-M-I... R-O-M...
R-O-M-E-C...
E-C-K...
No, there was no K on it.
E-C...
But this, we got a, you know, a black photo album with this stuff pasted in, and from what paper it was from, you know.
Sure,
right. They got one date. Some of the prices went from high as $200,000 down to $50,000. Actually, we got paid $19,000 for it.
Wow, that's a lot. Yeah. That was all profit. A lot of that was profit.
Well, we had to work on it and lay it out and turn it over to them. But I mean, the price, you know, you ought to have seen the estimates of the value. You know how they go.
Now, this photograph that you showed me, obviously just after it came out of the factory.
Well, yeah, I drove it out there.
It was taken in front of the Albright
art museum. Leave it to me. When I got into business and there were cars like that that were going to be photographed, I took them.
I noticed you that was one of your favorite backdrops.
It was, because we thought it was very appropriate for a high-class automobile. Out here was Delaware Park Lake. This was all part of the area that was built for that Pan American Exposition where McKinley was assassinated.
And this was the replica, or this was the...
Well, this was
one of the buildings.
One of two permanent buildings. The other one is the historical building, which was over on the other side of the lake.
Are both of them still standing?
Oh, my, yes.
Right, you know, they're permanent buildings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The other buildings were... I don't know what they were made of, but they were all torn down. Yeah. They were white, but... Of course, I wasn't there. All I know is what they told me.
Well, this is a supreme example, I suspect, the Shah of Persia's personal gold-plated Pierce Arrow brun-bodied limousine or town car. But as we mentioned earlier, this era ended pretty much with the Great Depression. And aside from periodic orders throughout the 30s, you and your father and Mr. Wepner really had a heck of a time keeping the company together.
I told you my father didn't get any money for a few years.
Now this must have took its toll in your father's physical and emotional health.
Yes, it did.
How did that happen? How did it gradually unfold? The pressures of trying to keep a business together with no profitability was...
Yes, because Mr. Judkins, I told you, was supposed to be a Wall Street Judkins.
Judkins, right.
Wall Street lawyer, and right. Willoughby was supposed to be a...
Willoughby?
A college professor. Mm-hmm. But Herman Brennan and Ray Diedrich and... Tom Everett.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. They were doing it to earn their living, but they also loved it, see?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my father thought that I've heard him say, what better thing can a man leave his son in a successful business?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't turn out that way, and nothing is personal. It's
permanent.
Permanent.
Yeah. So what happened? What were some of the stresses in
I don't know. It was
inner family?
It was a Sunday morning, and mother...
What year?
1941, September. 1941, September 21st, and mother used to walk... Augusta and I were living out on the lakeshore at our summer home.
Where was that?
In Wanaka, Hamburg, New York, Wanaka, on Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And... Mother would walk down to the corner and get on the bus and ride down to the First Presbyterian Church and go to church and come back. And when she came back, why, Mary, the maid, said, well, Mr. Brunt came down and had his breakfast, but he went back to lay down.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother went up there and looked in his room, and he was dead.
Mm. Natural causes?
Yeah, cerebral hemorrhage.
Yeah,
uh-huh. He had one before.
Had he? How many years earlier?
Pardon?
How many years earlier had he had one?
Probably 2 or 3 years.
So really,
I understand if you have one, you're apt to have another one.
Yeah. So it's your impression, looking back on it, that those that troubled decade from, say, 31 to 41 was a really, really tough for your father?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. I can't say anything else except that I think what hit him hard was when he was finally faced with signing on that line.
To liquidate. How'd that come about? He finally had no more reserves.
He had to admit it.
Uh-huh. And that was an early form of bankruptcy, wasn't it?
No. We liquidated the thing, paid the creditors, and had some left over.
Liquidated, in other words, you sold your assets.
Yeah.
Your physical plant.
This is what is known as liquidation.
Yeah. Who'd you sell the physical plant to?
Well, this is another good story.
Yeah.
We didn't own that plant.
You didn't?
No.
The famous 896? What street was it on again?
980 Ellicott Street. Well,
980
here's how this all came about. This was owned by a Schaefer estate. Christian Schaefer was a very friendly man, and my father was in this other building on Main Street, across from Uncle Henry's.
Yeah.
And he needed more room, and he jumped out the back window one day into a field that was all full of high grass, and he waded back, and here was this area, big area there, and he went to Mr. Schaefer, and by God, if Schaefer didn't build a building for him.
I spell Schaefer.
And
how do you spell Schaefer? Do you remember offhand?
Yeah, Schaeffer, Christian Schaefer.
No relation to the Schaefer Pen Company?
No. They were real estate elderly men in Buffalo.
Okay.
And Schaefer built the building for him.
Oh, to his specifications?
Yeah, to his specifications.
To your father's specifications.
There was already a building there, and he built this other place on, and it was two stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they paid him rent, they rented it, and Brown and Company rented it. And then when business got so good there through the 20s, when I told you George Walker was hollering for 19 of these a month and all this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
we had to have more room, and they went out looking around, and they found the old Stewart Motor Company truck. This was a truck that was built in Buffalo.
And had folded.
Well, I don't know whether it, I guess it had folded. It was a nice building, but geez, I'm glad they didn't buy it. Then they went back and they got with Schaefer's and they said, look, we need another story on this building and we'll build it if you won't increase the rent.
Mm-hmm.
And Schaefer said, all right, you build it. This would turn out to be the paint shop, the paint for, and they were coming into spray booths and things at that time. Built the spray booths and the vents and things up there, and then they didn't increase the rent any.
Wonderful.
At that time, it looked advantageous to the Schaefer's. I don't know who owns it now. There's a number of, I haven't been back there, well, since I came to California, but 8 years ago, but Marjorie has, and it's broken up into another place, a bunch of places. There's a printer that does big printing work in there, she said, and she couldn't tell me what else.
What assets did, if you didn't have the building or the factory, mm-hmm. what assets did you have, physical assets?
Equipment.
Equipment.
Yeah.
Car building equipment, bodybuilding equipment.
Well, like power hammers. Power hammers and the things that form metal, you know, and
mm-hmm.
Someplace in there, there's a picture of them putting a panel through the power hammer that's coming down like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what we did have that was most interesting in those days, due to the woodwork, were shapers.
Oh.
Did you ever see a shaper?
No, what's it like?
She said, wicked. But this is the way you would shape the door pillars and things like that. You put it in a jig with a couple of handles on it, and here's these two spindles turning around.
Uh-huh.
And it would follow this guide that you had on your wood, and eventually you'd get that same shape.
Uh-huh.
These were in demand at that time. Now, what I had tried to do after my father died, even, and I was pretty close to to doing it, United Aircraft, Pratt & Whitney division, needed boxes, crates.
Yeah, large wooden crates.
Large wooden crates to ship those engines in.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I ran around and I got, well, geez, there was order was good. The first order was going to be for 5,000. I think they built 25,000 of Chevrolet had the order. And Chevrolet had a plant in Tonawanda, that was a suburb of Buffalo. And it looked like we were going to get these for $50 a piece. And this would have been all right. I went down and got prices on parts and hinges because it was kind of a cradle, you know.
Ah, okay.
The lower part, it was made out of 2x4s and things like that. The axle or whatever it is in the plane sat down in this cradle, and then the cover was put on the top.
Right.
One day I went out to Tonawanda, and the fellow said, well, we decided we've got all this equipment here, and we're not going to have this plane standing idle. Can't do anything else, so we're going to make them ourselves. So. This is when I moved to Detroit.
Well,
no, I wrote to Mr. Ford, it was Henry II, and told him the situation, and I got a letter right back from his name was E.C. Stevens, the secretary. Said Mr. Ford would be glad to have you come up. He's trying to form a new organization, and some have come already. This was Martin Rogitko, and. If you will come up and if you'll call me on the phone. Well, by that time I got ready to call him on the phone, I got another letter telling me to go and see Gregory. So I went to see Gregory and went to work there.
I wonder if you could read one more paragraph for me.
Sure.
This is sort of a postscript of the custom car business in which your father was starting here with the second paragraph.
You mean no story?
Yes, right.
A custom coachwork in America can be told without giving the utmost credit to Mr. Edsel Ford and the Ford Motor Company. For the part he played in the promotion of this type of craftsmanship on the Lincoln chassis. During this difficult period in the life of this great profession, the Ford Motor Company, due to Mr. Ford's desire to keep the coach builders in business, took no profit for themselves on the sale of the bodywork. Brunn hung on longer than any of the other coach builders, except Durham, who still survives in Rosemont, Pennsylvania.
That was some years ago.
This is not true anymore. Martin Rogitko saw this handwriting on the wall as far back as 1938, and he left Willoughby and joined the Ford Motor Company Surface Layout Department. Judkins turned temporarily to the building of lunch wagons before finally liquidating. Victor Lang and the other key men of the Brunn organization were loyal to the end and stayed on to their financial disadvantage as long as the boss wanted to try to keep going. All would have been better off if they had liquidated in the late 1930s rather than holding out until 1941 as they did.
Right, thank you.
And now, that's the God's honest truth.
Right, and now, was it your father's conviction that the corner might be turned somewhere along toward the end of the decade and 30s.
Well, it was everybody's hope. I don't know whether it's conviction, but there was a lot of.
I mean, in terms of custom coach work.
I don't know. I don't know. It was.
Did you ever ask him, Dad, why are we hanging on? Why don't we liquidate? Did you ever go to
work? I was hanging on because I was enjoying the work.
Of course, yeah. Right. But you could see that things weren't going well.
Well, I could also see pressure from all around to liquidate before there isn't anything left.
True. But you, your father finally decided to liquidate. It must have been a painful decision for him.
It must have what?
It must have been a painful decision for him.
Well, I tell you what was such a painful decision for him was when they moved him out of his office.
Oh, really?
What happened? Yeah, that was the night before he died. I mean, selling the desk right out from under her.
Really?
Well, actually, we didn't sell that desk. I kept that in storage in Buffalo for 4 or 5 years after I came to Detroit, but there was no...
Good for you.
There was no sense in it because it was flat-top desk to bring us from here over to the wall, but that desk out there is the one that he did most of his designing on, that one that's out in the living room.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, your father was a remarkable character, wasn't
Yes, he?
He
was,
yes.
Except that... you know, it's just saying that, well, Franklin Roosevelt mentioned it in one of his speeches, that where there is no vision, the people perish.
Exactly.
I thought he originated that. Jesus Christ did, in one of the Sermons on the Mount.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found this out later.
Uh-huh. You thought it applied to your father perfectly?
This applied to my father, where there was no, he didn't have vision, he was old and, well, he was only 67 when he died, but he was sick with prostate gland trouble and...
nothing you could do anything for it in those days.
Had a stroke, you know, and we wouldn't let him drive a car, and a fellow went down to pick him up and bring him to work every morning and things like that. And and then when they finally began moving the furniture out, I had got the pictures and all these things off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And... funny thing, I was working on a rendering of an amphibious vehicle. It was an amphibian car corporation that took over part of and some of the equipment there. And I was making this rendering of this amphibious vehicle when a lady across the street called and said that my mother had been over and my father was dead and would I come right in, see?
Where were you working at that time?
Pardon?
Where were you working at that time?
In our sun porch in our house out on the lake.
Oh,
shore.
I see. Yeah, okay.
So then we had to get rid of that and had to got together and sold some of the equipment, especially the sheet metal equipment, to this fellow that was developing an amphibious vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
He never built more than half a dozen of them, because I guess Dodge and General Motors got
an amphibious vehicle for the armed forces?
Yeah, for the armed forces.
And Ford finally got a portion of that contract.
Did Ford get some of that too?
The amphibious Jeep. The amphibian Jeep.
Pardon?
The amphibian Jeep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So so the company, your father was buried, and what happened to your mother?
Oh, mother, she lived until we came to Detroit. She
really?
Died in 19, she was 70 years old. She died in, wait a minute, I was just...
1948?
48?
Yeah.
1948. 48,
she stay in Buffalo?
She stayed with us, and then she became quite a burden, because like Augusta couldn't find her and wanted to be out walking the streets and that.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden she'd be in fine shape. What do you call that?
Alzheimer's.
Arterial sclerosis.
Oh, arterial. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, all of a sudden she's perfectly normal. See.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Or multiple sclerosis.
Well, I thought that was.
Well,
no,
be
this
debilitated.
Was arterial.
Arterial, okay, fine, good, yeah. You're right.
Anyway, she went back up to Watertown. Her home was in Watertown. She lived in a very nice home up there.
Watertown, New York?
Watertown, New York,
the
where her Babcocks were.
Oh, yes, right, yes. Okay.
And well, she died up there, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Did she know the Babcocks when she lived in Watertown?
Oh yeah, they knew the Babcocks. Her name was Murray. They knew the Babcocks.
Interesting juxtaposition of the Babcocks and the Bruns.
Especially because my father worked there.
Right. Yeah. Did they meet then?
Yeah, they met there. My grandmother, she was a son of a gun because they had a lot of snow in Watertown, you know.
Yeah. Right.
And he was over there visiting the girls. There were three girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they really got snowed in, and she made them stay there all night.
Uh-huh.
And my father was a her grandfather was an army officer, had been in the Spanish War. And she put a pair of army boots and gaiters and a couple of overcoats on them and gave them lunch and started them off to work over the other side of the city, you know.
Good heavens.
In the fall, I've got picture. I've got a picture of her that next day. The snow was, had been plowed, but it was way up over her head, you know.
What happened to your grandfather, or her grandfather?
Well, her grandfather, he came down to the lakeshore when we were living on the lakeshore, and well, he had a heart attack out there because he went in swimming and he shouldn't have gone in swimming, and but he was only 60.
Mm.
And here I am, almost 80, and I'm swimming like a fish now.
I heard you were doing some water skiing down in San Diego.
Yeah, well, it's much better. What happened was I strained the ligaments down around here.
That's incredible.
I thought it was a...
You're almost 80?
Well, I'll be 70. I am 78 now.
That's incredible.
Just a 79.
Yeah, you're looking great. Well, I think you're in your... mid-60s.
Geez, I wish I was. Boy, if we only were.
Those were the days, huh?
Yeah, those were the great days.
Well, I mentioned your father, and I don't want to leave him short changed here, because he was obviously a gentleman of considerable talent and expertise and vision and very good taste in design. And I'm sorry that, in a way, the last decade of his life must have been so terribly a burden to him.
Him.
And to everyone. And that this glorious era of the 20s that he contributed so much to.
See, he seemed to be doing pretty well. We didn't get married until 1936. Incidentally, it'll be 50 years old. It'll be 50 years this December 28th.
Really?
And we didn't get married until 1936, and my father was the best man at the wedding, and he was driving in the car just like that to that touring cabriolet up there.
Which one?
The first one in from the end, the brown one in front of the art gallery.
Now that was
1938.
What body was that? Was that the Lincoln?
That's the Lincoln touring cabriolet.
Yeah, those were gorgeous cars.
Oh yeah, well, you know, he always believed that the shoemaker's children shouldn't go barefoot, you know.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
Because now, like that LaSalle up there, that got business not from LaSalle, but it got it from Edsel Ford on Lincoln.
Right.
It didn't look so well on Lincoln because of the stubbiness of the chassis. But...
You weren't able to stretch it out in those days, huh?
No, but... he always had a job there of his own, and then, of course, year, use it a year or so, and then he'd sell it. And listen, who was the boss and the general manager now at the Ford Hospital?
That was
great friend of
Ernest Liebold.
Hmm?
Ernie Liebold?
No. This fellow was a great friend. His father was a great friend of Edsel's.
Father was a great friend of Edsel's. Was he a surgeon?
No. He was a parts man. Wait a minute.
Just introduce it. You had promised to tell us the story of the Franklin Roosevelt special vehicles, and I believe there was an earlier one before the White House. Or was there an earlier one in the 30s that you did?
No, this was
just the
36.
Okay, give us the background on some detail.
Well, in 1936, George Walker and Chris Helis and those fellows said, could we build a convertible sedan on a 160-inch wheelbase ambulance chassis for the White House garage, and here with the Secret Service, attached with the Secret Service specifications.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's right in there, isn't it?
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah, there it is.
Because at the time
160 inch. You said
160, wasn't it?
You said 136, yeah.
No, 160.
Okay, right.
And I wrote quite an interesting story for Antique Automobile about tying that McKinley carriage in with this White House car back in 1976 with this, what was it called? What was it, 1976? 200 years? What do you call it?
The 100th year of the, 100th year of the...
No, it was 200 years of the signing of the...
Oh, the bicentennial.
The bicentennial. They tied that in with the McKinley car.
So that was the 76th article for antique car involving the first first run body? Or was that another antique car?
Antique automobile.
Antique automobile. I'm sorry.
I got a copy of the magazine right out there.
Yeah, I know. The first one you told me that was antique car, wasn't it? About the first run body.
Yeah.
They
wanted me to tie in that White House car with this McKinley car, and it made an interesting article. And they had an issue which was all dedicated to the bicentennial. This is where I learned that the first man in the White House to have automobiles in the White House was William Howard Taft.
Ah, yes, right. But, however, he did not go to his inauguration.
No, he didn't. I read the other day about that, but he had him in the garage after that.
That's correct.
Because they had his picture up there. we'd love to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And here were the specifications, see?
Right.
Well, it called for extremely high headroom, which made a ridiculous-looking vehicle.
Right.
But this was on account of the president's infirmity, and that you had to bend over to get in, you know,
right.
and all this kind of stuff.
Right. Uh-huh.
And we wrote back to Major Cunningham. He was the Washington representative. Did you ever hear of him?
Yes, of who?